This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name's Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And this week, we bring you something a little different. We are not doing a panel. We're just going to have the interview. And that's because Fred Kish and I, well, mostly Fred, I just kind of came in later on, we sat down with legendary science fiction and fantasy author David Drake. And it was just such a great conversation that I wanted to kind of highlight that for you. So no panel. So sit back, relax, take a listen to this, and hopefully you'll just enjoy it as much as we did. Again, legendary science fiction and fantasy author, Mr. David Drake.
How do you like The Enchanted Money, Fred?
That one I read quite a while ago. That was with paired with the El Sprague de Camp?
Yes. Yeah, I actually wrote that to get The Undesired Princess back in print.
Right, The Undesired Princess and The Enchanted Bunny.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to say it, but I've read so many books by so many authors that unless it's kind of rejiggered into the short-term memory, I can remember a title, but oftentimes very little else.
Oh, well.
So what I've been mostly rejiggering lately has been Redliners and Hammer Slammers. So,
okay.
Those are the most recent. Okay, let's give it a whack again. This is Fred Kish of the SF Signal Irregulars, and this evening I have the pleasure of bringing David Drake to our listening audience. David is an author of horror, science fiction, fantasy, and more. He started writing in the late 1960s. Took a couple of years off to go on a tour of Southeast Asia, courtesy of the U.S. government, and returned, where he started writing more and more while also practicing law as a town attorney, then moving into transportation, and finally, to the satisfaction of us all, into full-time writing. So, everyone who's listened to the podcast before has known that I'm been a longtime fan of his writing. If you've read my blog, The Lensman's Children, you know that I'm even more of a fan of his writing. So here we go. I'd like to start tonight by talking about some of the collaborations you've worked on. You have collaborated with a number of authors, and ranging from working on a shared world universe where you suggest a theme and kind of helm the project, to working on projects with people like Eric Flint and most recently John Lampsheed. Can you talk with us a little bit about your collaborative process, or do you see yourself as the name, for example?
Well, yeah, I can talk about it, but the most important thing to say about it is, yes, I have done a whole lot of collaborative projects, various sorts, and every one of them was somebody else's idea. I agreed to do it, and I did stuff, but never once was it something that I pushed. And this is actually pretty significant, because as much as I've done, it looks like I was the motivator, and I wasn't. And they vary. A number of my collaborations, the one I consider real collaborations, I've written half a book, and somebody else has written half a book, and both our names are on it. The other kinds of collaboration, though, have mostly involved me writing a plot outline and somebody else taking my plot outline and developing a novel from it. This isn't just me putting my name on it. When I say a plot outline, I mean something of 5,000 to 15,000 words. Create the world and do a scene by scene breakdown of the action. But still, the other person is doing a lot more work, and that's different. That was Jim Bain's idea. He got the notion that, or he and Bill Fawcett, between them, got the notion that this way he could get more books from me, which isn't really true. But he would get a bright idea, and I would do a plot for him. But if I did a plot and he got somebody else to write it, then I didn't have to write it. And his ideas frequently weren't things that I was particularly enthusiastic about, but I could do the plot. He got very, very high on the notion that Belisarius and the whole indirect approach to problems, instead of attacking things straight on, you come at it from the side, or you move around behind the other guy and force him to attack you, the sort of thing that was ascribed to the Byzantine general Belisarius. He got very much into J.F.C. Fuller, until I explained to him that Fuller was a fascist. And you know, the reason his career went nowhere was he was a right-wing wacko before World War II. And if you actually look at what he's really writing, a lot of his facts are non-facts, which Jim didn't have the background to know. But there's plenty of evidence that, you know, what Fuller was doing was making stuff up to make it look good. But it did look good, and Jim got very enthusiastic about it, and that's where the Belisarius series came from.
Right.
And the General series before that. So mostly I've been simply doing most of what you're thinking of as collaborations. I've been doing plot outlines. And some of the writers spend a lot of time talking with me as they develop stuff, and some of them don't. And I'm a resource, but it's, you know, it's really their choice as far as I'm concerned. Is that helpful?
Well, do you see yourself as a mentor to these authors in some way? You know, developing the next generation, as it were.
Ooh, no, no, I don't. Although I think it actually has worked that way in a couple cases, but that's not at all how I've seen myself. I was doing a task for Jim Bain, who was a really close friend, and if somebody asks me for help on something, whether it's, you know, a project of mine or one of his own, I'll help. I mean, you know, why not? But I don't think of it as, you know, I am giving back to the community. Now, where I did do that was for 15 years, I was the associate editor of Whispers magazine.
Right.
And I read an awful lot of horror slush from the you know, the early 70s through the late 80s. And that Mr. Derleth, August Derleth of Arkham House, mm-hmm. had bought my first four stories and had helped me a great deal in various fashions. And when I was reading slush for Stu Schiff, who was the editor-publisher of Whispers, I did consciously consider myself I'm doing it for other people because Mr. Derleth did it for me. But not with the collaboration, not with the outline stuff. That was just me and Jim shooting the bull and coming up with neat stuff, and me just, you know, sort of tossing it to Jim and saying, do what you do, you know, do whatever you want to do with it. It wasn't a deep thing. It was just me and a friend.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've also, in your long history of writing, you've also collaborated, in a sense, with two dead authors. Your book, The Jungle, was a sequel of sorts to Henry Kuttner and C.L. Moore's stories Clash by Night and The Fury. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that project?
Oh, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful. Clash by Night. Fury, when I reread it as an adult, and I've read it a number of times, but when I reread it as an adult, I saw that it is badly padded, but it really hit me when I was 14 years old. And Clash by Night, I'd read a little sooner than that. And those were very, very powerful influences on me. And I don't know if you remember, but Tor was doing doubles.
Right.
And Marty Greenberg approached me on doing a Tor double, and I said, well, you know, could I do a sequel to Clash by Night? And he thought that was, not sequel, but, you know, in the world of, because I don't really do sequels in that sense. And he said that was fine. There were some problems with Tor, oddly enough. It didn't get as high up as... See, what had happened, Tom Doherty started Tor, and he brought Jim Bain in almost immediately as... actually, technically, for a while, Jim was the editorial director. That changed. But I was one of their authors at ACE, and I started working for them at Tor. And then Jim was approached to take over the Pocketbook science fiction line, and instead worked out with Tom as a partner, as a matter of fact, created Bane Books as a distributed science fiction line for Pocket rather than being an actual Pocket employee. But at the point Jim left Tor, Tom and I were friends. I didn't have any other friends at Tor. So when the project of doing this sequel to Clash by Night came up, the editor in charge of the project decided that they already had a Kuttner-Moore project in hand, Vintage Season, that Robert Silverberg was doing a sequel to, and they didn't want me doing another one. So, okay. So I wound up doing that book, which was Surface Action. By the time Tom heard about it, it was basically too late. And that wound up coming out from ACE. But because of the flap, I then did The Jungle for Tor, you know, just for Tom. And it was a chance to do books that were in a world that had really been very important to me. And I got Clash by Night reprinted by doing that, which was the main reason I did it, actually. Does that make any sense?
And oh, yes.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. In a similar vein, a few years ago, you wrote the introduction, and I assume you were instrumental in getting Bain Books to publish a trio of books by Mark Gesten.
Oh, yes. Yes, 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 I was.
can you talk about those books and why you felt so strongly about them to get them back into the public eye?
Yeah, it blew me away when I remember. I read those in the late 60s, early 70s. And Mark Gesten was just the hottest thing going. I mean, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful writer. And really, really bleak work, which at that time, remember, I had been drafted and sent to Cambodia and Vietnam. And he perfectly caught, I thought, the feel of the world that Mr. McNamara had put me into. You know, just hellish, pointless, bleak violence. And wonderfully written books as well, very subtly plotted. They really worked for me. And it turned out, when I learned a little more about him, they're both trained as lawyers and both going to very good law schools. I think he was at Princeton, I was at Duke. And I got drafted and he didn't get drafted. And he wound up, well, I won't say wind up, but wound up, because he's still practicing very successfully in Idaho. And I got drafted and basically left the law after I got my head up far enough to get out of it. And I wound up in full-time writing. But you could view us as a double-blind experiment of what happens when you draft one bright young lawyer and don't draft the other. And I'd always, they're very, very good books in their way. And I convinced the publisher of Bain Books, Toni Weisskopf. I convinced her to take them. They were, in her mind, they were absolutely everything that Bain isn't. And she published them as a favor to me, and also as a payback for, there'd been a screw up that cost me a good deal of anguish, and she knew she'd screwed up, and she apologized, and I said, now let's talk about the cover we're going to have on the Gaston trilogy. And she said, damn, I guess we got to do it. She was right. The books did quite reasonably well, by the way.
I bought 3 copies myself and gave them away. Gave away 2.
Okay, you know how good they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm very proud of that. I'm glad to have gotten those back in print. But as I say, in 1969. Everybody knew who Mark Gaston, everybody in the field knew who Mark Gaston was, and nobody knew me. And there was a reason for that. Now, you know, we just went in different directions. And I would have been perfectly happy not to be drafted. But I didn't have that option. And I don't know, maybe I'd have been a happier lawyer, huh? It's a hideous thing to think, though, isn't it? Oh, well.
I have the misfortune of working with lawyers during my day job, so...
Yeah.
I think you're better off. In a similar vein, you majored, if I remember correctly, in the study of Latin as an undergraduate, mm-hmm. took Latin
yeah,
with
history
you...
history and Latin.
Okay, mm-hmm. history and Latin. Took mm-hmm. Latin texts with you in the military, mm-hmm. and even to this day, regularly you transcribe and publish on your site translations you've done. Can you talk about why you've got such a fascination with Latin and how it has helped you in your writing and in your life?
Well, I used to say that it kept me sane. Obviously, that isn't really true, but it keeps me a lot closer between the ditches than I'd be without it. I took Latin in high school, and I wasn't especially good at it. I was good at psych translation. I did not do the work. and, you know, I got adequate grades. But when I got to college, I switched to German because this was a more useful thing. I was going to become a patent attorney and learn German and take chemistry and, you know, all this sort of thing. And I probably could have done it, but it was breaking me. University of Iowa is a very good school. There were 15,000 students in it. There had been something under 300 in my graduating class, and, you know, my high school, and I think only about 30,000 in the town, the city I was living in at the time. So going to Iowa was this huge, wrenching change for me. And everything was, you know, kind of going to pieces. And I finally decided that the one thing I could do to anchor myself was to drop German and get back into Latin, not because I liked it especially, but it's because it was what I'd done in high school, and I'd had a pretty good time in high school. So I switched back to Latin, and it did center me very well. And I wound up taking, I was actually a history major by that point, but I wound up taking a great deal of Latin. And when I realized I was going to have something like 30 semester hours, I went to my advisor and I said, "Hey, could I have a double major?" And he looked at the situation, and I think I should technically have had another year of Greek. I only had 1 year of Greek, but he said, "Yeah, you know, why not?" So that's how I wound up, you know, a double major. And I continued to use it in Duke Law School. I was taking courses in the School of Liberal Arts, taking Latin courses. And, I carried texts with me in the Army. It's something solid and rational and very, very distant from the things that were very close to me and were very awful at the time. And, you know, it's still a good way to focus myself on something that isn't work but takes great concentration. And I'm putting them up on my website, not so much because I think people are going to be clamoring for my translations, although they're good translations. But if I put them up in public, then everybody can see them, and that forces me to do them as well as I can. I can't put them up and say, that's good enough. Because, you know, when you say, that's good enough, what you really mean is, that isn't good enough. And so just being public about it forces me to be honest, is all. The other thing is, when you do a translation, a serious translation, you're forced to really get into the mechanics of what the other author was thinking, saying. And if you're picking good authors, and Ovid, whom I've mostly been concentrating on, Ovid was an extremely skilled craftsman. And I'm really getting insight. He could do things that are extremely difficult if you've seen somebody try to do them who isn't brilliant. When you have Apollo killing the seven sons of Niobe, and you have a line or two lines on the death of each of the kids. And how do you do that and keep each one fresh and separate? That's very difficult. But it's the sort of thing that a writer may have to do. And if you've ever seen it done, well, I won't even say badly, done by most people, it's boring. You know, they're just cookie cutters. They're pointless. Ovid makes each one, each event, separate, distinct, and gives the victim, in this case, character. And, boy, you can learn from that. You know, I have.
Hey, Fred.
Because it'll work in a space battle, too. You know, that's the thing. I say the Seven Sons of Niobe, but you think of a space battle, and you got ships blasting at each other. How do you make the, you know, ship explode, ship explode, ship explode? How do you make those different? And, okay, I've got a head start on that because I've read somebody who is an expert at it. So there.
Hey, I just wanted to interject for a second. When you talk about Latin, that is something that is close to my own heart because I took that in high school as well. Mm-hmm. And we had a fantastic teacher who taught Latin and French. And she taught Latin the way you teach other foreign languages that are still alive today. In other words, she made us speak it when we came into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, when you think about it, is kind of crazy because it's not a spoken language anymore. But when we went to that classroom, we spoke in Latin.
It was actually a spoken language into the 17th century. You perhaps know that John Milton was the Secretary of State under Cromwell. Do you know why he was?
No.
He was the only person in Cromwell's government, which was, you know, rural squirearchy, really. He was the only one in the government who was fluent in Latin. He wrote poems in Latin. And Latin was the diplomatic language of the day. So he was the only person who could speak to the ambassadors. And that's why John Milton was Oliver Cromwell's Secretary of State.
That's also a dangerous job to have, I would think.
Oh, well. It was better to be Cromwell's friend than Cromwell's enemy. I tell you, you got to respect the man. You've got to. His worst enemies respected him, and God knows he had enemies.
Anyway, I apologize, Fred. I didn't mean to take you off track.
Oh, no, no problem.
No. Hey, what's a track?
I think right now I'd like to move over to Hammer Slammers for a while.
Okay.
That's certainly probably what you're best known for, despite the fact that it's been a couple of years since anything has been written on it.
Right.
Your one book, Sharp End, was inspired by Dashiell Hammett's The Glass Key and Red Harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Leary of the RCN was inspired by Patrick O'Brien.
Yeah, I'll do his, everybody.
His books are set in the Napoleonic era, and you've also got a relationship in there similar to his books with Aubrey and Maturin and O'Brien's works, and you've got Captain Leary and Adelie Mundy in your books. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about these books and possibly other things that have inspired you, for example, in Paying the Piper, a historical event inspired you there. Rolling Hot, another historical event inspired you there. I mean, between Latin and history, you seem to be able to come up with quite a few plot lines.
There's some people ask, well, where do you get your plots? Oh, geez. You know, they're all over the place. Anything.
I thought there was a warehouse in upstate New York.
Well, I'll tell you, this is actually true. Douglas Dold, the brother of the artist Elliot Dold, D-O-L-D, really did sell plots for, you would send off to him, and he would send you three mimeographed strips, generally pretty battered. And they would be a simple plot germ. And if you used one and sold it, I think you sent him, $2.50, something like that. And you sent the other plots, the other two, back. And then he, which is why they were kind of battered. But this is no fooling. I mean, I knew Hugh Cave, the very fine pulp and slick writer, horror writer in later years. And he had actually done this. So there was somebody out there selling plots. And, you know, I can tell you his name. mostly I just, I'll steal from anybody. Cross the Stars is very directly from the Odyssey. The Voyage did a similar turn on the Argonautica of Apollonius of Rhodes. And The Warrior, which is one of the Hammer short novels, is really an exegesis on the Wrath of Achilles. This is Homer's Achilles the way Horace, in his Art of Poetry, tells you to write him. And that, in that case, I use the Iliad in a much different fashion from the fairly direct one-to-one job that I did with the Odyssey and then later with the Argonautica. But, you know, picking a historical event, you know, you mentioned paying the piper. How many people have really heard of the Rhodes-Byzantium War of the late 3rd century? I mean, I've just, however many are listening to the podcast have now heard about it. It's not very well known, but it's a very complex thing. And you've got the details of how the politics worked, really. You're not bound, you know, I'm not writing a historical novel. I'm writing a space opera. But that allows me to change things, but I'm not required to change them. I mean, I know how the politics really did work, so I don't have to invent something to get a real, no, this is true, or was true, information out. So if you don't have to worry about that, if you don't have to worry about, well, what would they do here? Oh, I know what they would do here because that's what they did here. Then you can focus on character. And character is, I think, where fiction is character, I think.
Well, speaking of some characters,
yeah.
Between those two series, Hammers and Leary, I noticed some interesting parallels. I mean, in Hammers, you've got Joachim Steuben.
Yep.
In Leary, you've got Adelie Mundy. Adele, sorry. In one, we've got someone who probably is not human at all in many ways, and in the second, you've got somebody who's trying to learn how to be human.
Yes. Well, sociopaths are real. And the smart sociopaths, they may not have consciences, but they do have a good... they're able to consider cause and effect. And the fact that they don't feel something doesn't mean that they can't ape human feelings, because that's the way to survive. If you've watched or read Dexter, where you've got a sociopathic killer.
Right.
And you look at him, and he's actually a perfect husband. He's a perfect co-worker because he is doing everything by intelligent study. He's doing it right because he doesn't have instinct. He's actually studying what a good co-worker does. He comes to work with donuts. He's pleasant to people. He does his job. He does extra work for folks as favors. because they'll like him. And it isn't natural to him, but it's the way that somebody should behave. So he studied it. And that's what De Vera is doing in the RCM series. She knows she's a consciousless monster, but she can attach herself to Adele Mundy, who has a lot of problems but is human. And by studying what Adele would do and doing what Adele tells her to do, she can avoid being killed as the monster that she is. I have... Those are not stupid characters. I'm rather pleased with them.
Well, in Redliners, you seem to have someone who was almost a model for Adele in Tamara Lundy or Miss Chun. Very, very smart, but very detail-oriented, dips into the information, but may not know how to relate to people.
Yeah, well, there are people like that. That's, you know, I'm not basing a character on a particular person, usually. But all the character traits are those I've seen in other people, or frankly, have seen in myself. I not infrequently have had the feeling I don't dislike human beings. I don't feel I quite am one. It's like watching society through a 6-inch glass plate. You know, I often wish I understood how it was done better, but I'm doing the best I can. So if that comes through in the fiction, then, well, that's fair, isn't it?
Another thing that's... putting it delicately, you've had a kind of interesting relationship with the critics over the years. But looking at Hammer Slammers and looking at Leary and looking at Redliners, we have three strong female characters. In Hammer Slammers, I'm thinking of June Ransom in Rolling Hot.
Yeah,
female company commander.
Mm-hmm.
You've had black characters, if I recall. Now, of course, I'm forgetting the two brothers on the desert planet story.
But I think that's from Wolfram von Eschenbach, by the way, Fiera Fitz. But that really, no one cares about that. Okay, but yeah. There have, of course, always been gay characters in the fiction. But,
right.
You know, that's all of these are normal in my life, so why wouldn't they be in my fiction?
Well, what I was going to get at is, I mean, the Hammer Slammers have been in print since, I think, 78?
April 79 was the book publication. The first stories appeared in 1974.
Well, I was working 40 hours and going to school full time, so my dates get blurred back then.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't know myself except, you know, that was my first book.
And they've been in print ever since, and most recently came out with those beautiful hardcover omnibuses from Nightshade, and then the trade paperbacks from Bain. But
yeah,
can you talk about...
Wonderful.
Oh, yes. But given, I mean, you've strong female characters, multi-ethnic characters, multi-sexual orientation, all the elements that you think would attract critical reaction. Can you talk about the critical... Well... Here's where I'm going. Can you talk about the critical reaction versus the reaction of the fans, either science fiction fans or members of the military, to these stories?
I got abused quite a lot on the Hammer story, but it sort of took me aback. They're hard stories. They're stories about people doing hard things, and remember when the first Hammer stories came out, we were still in Vietnam. You know, they came out in 74. We didn't get out till 75, really. Got out from the roof of the embassy on helicopters. But the Vietnam War was a very hot-button issue. I was in no sense pro-war or anything like that. I'd been drafted out of law school. It had done a pretty good job of, you know, military service had done a pretty good job of destroying my life. Certainly the person that I was when I went in. And I'm not pro-Vietnam or anything like that. But at the time, and people tend to forget this now, it was the soldiers were the enemy. You know, Jane Fonda is the poster child for this, but she can't lie about it because she's, you know, she was photographed sitting at a North Vietnamese anti-aircraft gun aimed at American planes. She can't lie, but there were a lot of people like her. Probably a majority of people were like her. And they do lie now. Oh, you know, I opposed the war, but I never opposed the, I didn't hate the soldiers. That isn't true. They did. They hated us. And I was drafted. All of the people in my interrogation school unit were drafted. We couldn't have been in the particular language school program we were in if we hadn't graduated from college. So, you know, I was drafted out of Duke Law School. A buddy was drafted out of the old English program at Princeton. One friend was getting his PhD in zoology at the University of Chicago. You know, we were bright kids. And we certainly were not there by choice, but we were doing our jobs. And that made us monsters when we got back. And there were a lot of people, opinion makers in the science fiction field, who were very loudly and publicly of the opinion that anyone who didn't say soldiers were monsters was a monster himself. And I was very publicly saying, this is what it's like to be a soldier in a tank unit in what is now called asymmetric warfare. Because that's what the Hammer Slammers is. It's the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment with ray guns. And I've said that from the beginning. This is what it was like. And there were people who very much disliked me, disliked what I was saying, what they thought I was saying, but just disliked me because I was a veteran. That all started changing when the wall was opened in 1980. Made a huge difference in the way Vietnam veterans were portrayed. And at that point, the Jane Fondas became a threatened species. And everybody who could pretend otherwise did pretend otherwise. But, you know, it'd been a pretty rough 10 years. And I was writing in that period. And I was getting for a number of things, and one of them is I was actually I was effective. If I'd been a crappy writer, if the stories hadn't had an emotional impact, they might have been ignored. But I was actually successful, much more successful than I realized. So the, if you will, opinion makers, Charlie Brown and his ilk on the West Coast in particular, disliked me very much and very pointedly, and disliked me the more because the book succeeded. And nobody hates you if you're mediocre. I've been called a lot of things, but I'm not mediocre. I'm not middle of the road in any sense. And, I've lived longer than a lot of my critics, and the situation has evolved more. And I will say that one good thing that came out of the hatred that was spewed on Vietnam vets is that the soldiers coming back now, they have all the same problems that we did, but they don't have people spitting on them. And that really did happen. A buddy of mine mentioned one in the physics program, actually biology program at the University of Chicago. He came back after his tour, walked into the cafeteria, and a guy he knew from, you know, before he was drafted says, "Hey, Barnhouse, what's it feel like killing babies?" And, you know, that really was the world in the 1970s for Vietnam veterans among the intelligentsia. I can get angry about that if I let myself, so I don't.
Well, the critics were one thing, but the public reaction was something else.
There are a lot of veterans out there, and I was telling
them. And they buy
books. I was telling the truth. Yeah. Well, not only that, I was one of the few people who was actually, I was telling the truth as I knew it. That doesn't make it absolute truth, but it was a truth that the veterans knew also. And I immediately started getting letters from World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, as well as Vietnam veterans, saying, you know, this is how it is. Keep telling them. Maybe they'll understand. And, you know, the truth is they never will understand. But at least nowadays they'll try. And in 1971, there was no sign that anybody wanted to understand what had happened to the people they had sent to Vietnam to fight for them, to fight for the country. And that's, I don't think it mattered a lot to the veterans, to be honest, because I know in my case I was screwed up, and it wasn't because of anything bad that happened to me after I got back. I mean, I had a loving wife, I had good friends. I returned to Duke Law School. I may have been considered pretty weird, but Duke Law School was not a political place. People were interested in making money. They weren't, you know, politically concerned. And, you know, I didn't have a hard time, but I knew people who did. I just don't think that whether... I think it is to the country's discredit the way they treated Vietnam veterans.
I agree.
But I don't think it actually hurt the veterans.
Sorry, I had to pipe in. I agree.
Well, you know, I'm really glad that's changed for the people who are coming back now, because believe me, they're just as screwed up as we are, and for just as good a reason. It really isn't a human environment. I'm sorry, it just isn't.
Have you seen... Tom Hanks's The Pacific?
No. I read some of the books that it was based on.
The only reason I bring it up is because it deals with what goes into building a soldier who fights in a war, and then the impact of that soldier returning home afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was a point where one of the, you know, it follows the career of two characters, and one of the characters, when he returns home, at some point, you know, he's trying to get a job, and he's not doing very well. He's not able to reintegrate. And they, you know, someone asks him at one point, you know, well, what do you do? You know, what have you trained for? And he says, I've been trained to kill other men.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lovely bit in To Hell and Back by Audie Murphy, where three of them are sitting on a hillside. You know, Audie Murphy's memoir. Three of them are sitting on a hillside in Italy. And one of them says something about getting a job. You know, they'll be so glad to have us back. We'll be heroes. And another of them says, and I don't know if this was a true conversation that Murphy and his buddies had, or if it's just, you know, sort of the way Murphy was trying to congeal it. Yeah, I'm going to go, and I'm going to tell the guy doing the hiring, I can kill a man at 400 yards. I can throw a grenade farther than anybody else in this town. Give me a job. And, you know, it.
Yep.
Yep. Me, I write stories.
And great ones. So, Fred, we are we're coming up on almost an hour now.
Yeah, I was going to ask, should we wrap it up with one or two more, or
yeah, why don't you give them something a little bit more positive to close up on here?
Okay,
what, me negative?
Actually, got a couple of good positive ones.
Okay,
two positive and one two amusing.
There you go.
One. Actually, John Lampshead asked me to ask you a question, so we'll finish with that one. You've written horror. You've written,
yes, I have,
historical fantasy, regular fantasy,
yep,
military epic, science fiction,
epic
space
fantasy,
opera, right? Space opera.
Mm, oh yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
You've either edited or served as a creator on a number of anthologies. Now, a mm-hmm. lot of authors are afraid of diluting what they call their brand if they move from one genre to the other. But I mean, you are among the few that do it, and you don't seem to care.
You're right. I don't care.
Is there?
I do what I please. I do what I please, and life is. You know, I won't make you bleep this. Life is too darn short.
Well, this is the internet. You can use those words.
Okay, life is too fucking short. just, you know, do what you please. And if I want to do something, I do it. And, you know, sometimes it turns out to be a really bad idea. And that's okay. You know, it was worth trying. But, yeah, don't... I am not a brand. I am Dave Drake. I tell stories. And I realized fairly recently that if I had thought of myself as having a writing career and had been trying to build up my writing career, I wouldn't have had a writing career. I got where I am by doing what I wanted to do. And very frequently, the decisions I made at the time, because I felt like it, turned out to be exactly the right decision in the long term. But nobody could have guessed that. And I certainly didn't. I just did it because that's what I wanted to do. And you can't micromanage life. You really can't. It's too complex. I've got a good mind, and I know perfectly well that I cannot judge all the side effects of any action. Therefore, I'm going to do the thing that seems right at the time, right for me. And, you know, it'll either work out or it won't. And the weird thing is, it tends to work out. I'm glad of that.
Okay, now on to an amusing question. I've noticed that quite a few of your dedications, forewords, afterwards, talk about your special relationship with technology.
At this point, should we point out the problems with the phone in the beginning?
Yeah, I was going to say, yes. For example, I pick up on the cordless phone, and then I find the wired phone that I intended to use doesn't work.
You know, I'm sure there's a graveyard out there of personal computers you've put into the ground finishing books.
Oh, God, I have. I've killed so many. Well, look, part of it is I work outdoors. And this is North Carolina. So it isn't like I'm trying to do it in Montana. But, you know, I had one go spling, and that turned out to be a head crash. And as my friend Mark, who's very high up in the IT business, said,
Mark Van Dane.
Dave, yeah. Dave, all your data is now finely divided iron oxide on the bottom of your hard drive casing. that was just, I blow up motherboards regularly.
Oh, no.
I've had keyboards fail. Fail in varieties of ways, as a matter of fact. I think they ought to work where I work and when I work, and they often don't. And, you know, it's sad, but fortunately, you know, I have many close friends and my son now who are geeks of one sort and another, and they keep me supplied with, you know, computers or repair my computers, and it's just sort of a cost of doing business, like, you know, gasoline if you commute. I run through computers. And sometimes I'll go almost a year without losing a computer, and then I'll lose four in a matter of months.
I can do that with software.
Yes. Well, that's a similar thing, I'm sure.
What are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm talking on the phone with
y'all,
but until 5 minutes before you called, I was working on the next RCN space opera.
Ah.
So that's I've got about 4,000 words in draft on that, and I'll have another 120-some thousand. And then I'll turn it in, and then I'll start something else, which I think will be the next tour fantasy. I just I took a break of about 4 days reading proofs on the second of the new tour fantasy series. The proofs of that came, and so I, having started the space opera, I stopped and you know, read the proofs, and now I'm getting back into the space opera.
And by the way, I hope all your friends and family encourage you to back up often.
Oh, I always back up on three of my own computers, and as soon as I finish a text of, you know, usually about 4,000 words, I email it off to three friends in various parts of the country. So, you know, as I say, if an asteroid hits Pittsburgh, North Carolina, my work is going to be safe, unless it's a very big asteroid.
All right, do you have any convention plans this year?
Going to World Fantasy Con, and that's a big business convention.
Oh, but it was a lot of fun. I got to go this last year. That's where you and I met briefly in the dealer's room.
Yeah, well, you will definitely find me in the dealer's room quite a lot of the time. It is fun. My agent started it. back in 1975, Kirby McCauley, and
wow.
told me I had to go. I'm old, but I was at the. I don't go to all of them, but I've been to most, and I was at the first. So I was actually a judge on I think the third World Fantasy Awards ballot.
Wow.
I go back.
Fred, did you have a final wrap-up question?
A final question. I'm not sure if it's a wrap-up. I was tasked by your current collaborator, John Lampshead, to ask you, so, Dave, how's that stump-pulling project going?
Very darned well.
I have no idea why he asked me to ask you, but...
Well... You know, I'm 65, and I've
That's not that old.
We've got, well, yeah, it is, actually, but I'm in good shape because the past several years, we've got 23 acres, and we've got this lovely grove of oaks and hickories, but it was covered with undergrowth. And my wife decided she wanted it cleared, so I cleared it. With an axe and scythe, axe. And then the thing is, if you cut stuff up, it regrows from the roots. So I have been ripping roots out with a pick mask. And let me tell you, I'm in great shape for a man of my age.
Now, here's what I want to know. You cut all that hickory out. Did you then, you know... build yourself a barbecue pit and start smoking some meat?
No. Didn't
it's a,
cut
it's a legend.
It's, ah. Yeah. what I was cutting out are the evening olive and little trash plants like that, trash brush, that were growing up around the hickories and oaks. Actually, yes, I do an annual barbecue. And we used to... It has gotten... less and less traditional and more survivable. I started out back in the early 70s. I'd burn hardwood in one pile and then shovel the coals under the pig under a separate enclosed grill. And that is the really traditional fashion.
Mm.
But it means that you're sitting out there generally in the sun most of the day between two fires and smoke besides. And, you know, it was killing me. It was a great birthday party, but I didn't remember much of it. So we've gotten less and less traditional, although, you know, the pig still tastes really, really good, although it isn't really quite the same as when my wife would bring it home in the trunk of the car, and it had been butterflied with a chainsaw. And, you know, and it's the whole pig. I mean, tail through snout, but butterflied with a chainsaw.
Long-time listeners to the podcast and to the other podcasts, the Functional Nerds, and, you know, Fred can tell you this. I really only have three rules on the podcast. That is, you know, I don't want people to talk about politics, religion, or barbecue, because these are the three things that are the most polarizing topics in our country. And because everybody gets it wrong and they don't realize that the best barbecue comes from Kentucky.
I can understand why they don't understand that.
Well, you know, I wanna thank you for coming on the show. I wanna thank Fred for you know, steering this tonight. But I think we do need to call this an end because it is well over an hour now, and I don't know what to do with it yet.
Okay. Well, what I'm gonna do is go to bed.
Okay. Well, we appreciate you coming on. Hopefully, we will make it to World Fantasy again, and we will bump into you in the dealer's room.
I'll be there.
Well, thank you for coming on. You have a great evening.
You bet.
Thank you,
bye-bye.
David. Bye-bye.
Good to meet you, Fred. Bye-bye.
And there you have it, our interview with legendary science fiction and fantasy author, Mr. David Drake. Thanks again to Fred for all the hard work that he put into that interview. I really appreciate it. If you, the listener, have any thoughts or comments on this interview, please, please feel free to give us a call on our voicemail line, 720-277-9082. Or if you go to the post, there's a little flash widget there from Google, and if you plug in your phone number, Google will call you. We don't keep that number, but it does save you a dime on a long-distance call. Next week, we will have a panel again. So we'll have a panel and an interview as normal. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do us a favor. Tell a friend. Tell two friends. Spread the love around a little bit. Help us build a larger listenership for the podcast. You can also go to our page on iTunes and give us a rating or a review. That always helps as well and helps us to get a little bit more exposure to the general public. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a great week. Bye.